It's Monday night, and that means a new episode of Graphic Policy Radio, the show that mixes politics, and this night, movies and comics. This is the show for folks who know that ISIS is a terrorist group we may or may not be at war with, but also DC and Marvel character, a series published by Image and now Blue Water, and a cat owned by Catwoman that has appeared in Batman the Animated Series and Crypto the Superdog. Yes, Crypto the Superdog had an animated series. Yes, I got
yes.
that.
Oh my, this is a good one.
Tonight we're discussing a movie that has defied expectations, Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, which is currently a top-grossing movie here in North America so far in 2014, breaking $300 million this past weekend. Joining us for this discussion is Scott Kaufman, who you may know as SCK. Scott is the proprietor of AV's Club's Internet Film School and an associate editor at The Raw Story. He also writes for Lawyers, Guns, and Money, podcasts, is an expert on Game of Thrones. So tonight we are all Groot with Scott and my co-host Alana. How are you both doing?
I'm good.
I'm doing great.
disclaimer, I'm actually getting over a really bad cough. So if I'm not quite as vocal as normal, it might be because I had to put it on mute so I wouldn't deafen everyone.
That's okay. I listened to the new Leonard Cohen album today, so your voice actually sounds just completely normal to me. So.
Oh, my voice is completely normal. This is what I sound like. It's just I haven't.
I'm envious.
Coughing.
I sound like a hyperactive chipmunk, but, you know, you have a gravitas.
Exactly.
How shall we get started?
Well, I think to start with the easy one is, what did you both think of the film?
Oh, and I should also say that because the movie has been out for a while, I think we can talk
about
spoilers.
We can do spoilers. Yeah.
Can we do comic-related spoilers, too? Do you think people would be upset, or...?
No, I think it's worth discussing, because, I mean, the comic series, you kind of need to discuss the comic when dealing with the movie, so... Yeah. We'll just go spoiler warning to begin with. If you don't want to hear this stuff, probably don't listen.
Yeah.
Y'all fucker's been warned. All right, let's go.
Yeah.
Whoever wants to begin,
do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Scott, you can start.
Okay. I absolutely love the film. It's problematic in a number of ways, but all of those ways are, in fact, very conventional. It is a Hollywood movie, the kind of movie that it had to be in order to get made, but I think that within the limits that it had, it was actually probably the most fun I've had in a movie theater since I would have to go back to, like, The Two Towers, which was just for me, like, this sort of epic movie experience in a theater, and you know, it's all the Battle of Helm's Deep and stuff. This was that much fun, and I think whatever other criticisms we make of the film, and I have it on good authority that some other criticisms will be made, the fun quotient to this film was just spectacular, in my professional opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm passing the baton now. I have many other things to say, but I'll pass it for right now.
All right. We'll go with Alana next, and then we're leading to my dissenting opinion, apparently.
Yes. So I enjoyed the movie a great deal. Now, folks might know that I don't just go to see any old superhero movie. I only go to watch superhero movies that I can tell are going to be good, unlike poor Brett, who is, you know, willingly sacrifices himself when he goes to see things like Green Lantern just because mm-hmm. he's doing his journalistic duty for us as Americans. He is serving our needs by doing these things. But I don't have that kind of commitment. I only see superhero movies that are going to be good. This movie was really, really good. I should also stipulate I don't read the comic. I read tons of comics. I don't think I need to tell that people that at this point, since this is my podcast, but whatever, in case this is the first episode you listen to.
You're not a fake geek girl?
I'm not a fake geek girl. I'm a big Marvel person. But I never read Guardians of the Galaxy, really, so I'm not coming into this with a lot of strong feelings about how it's interpreting certain stories that already exist out there. But I know a lot about these pieces in the Marvel Universe, and I actually saw the film along with some friends at a drive-in theater, including a number of friends, some comic geeks, and one who, like, does not know comics at all. and she thoroughly enjoyed the movie as well. There were some pieces that I kind of had to explain to her along the way. You know, like, but they weren't things that would have prevented her from enjoying the movie. They just were things that, once explained, are even cooler, like the big flying head of the Celestial, which is so freaking cool.
I know.
It's like a giant, dead, mm-hmm. like a giant dead space gun. They're all inside the head of a giant dead space gun.
That's
anyway,
an old school sci-fi wonder, and that's what I love. Sorry, I'm.
Yes,
I didn't mean to interrupt, but
really
that's what
that.
I love.
I mean, I liked that it was. It had a really awesome female character. It would have been great for there to have been not just one female in the team, but all the characters in the main crew were distinct from each other. They were hilarious and compelling, and I really felt for them, and I really want to give Drax a hug. Like, Drax, I feel like Drax, in, to me, is like the breakaway star from this, actually. How sympathetic and amazing and well-acted he was, and hilarious. Everybody had already probably heard by now about how great Groot and Rocket were done. Zoe Saldana is obviously fantastic at being in, like, sci-fi movies. She was great. And there was lots of shirtless, what's his name? So that's good. People like that. I like that.
People.
I'm serious, dude. People like that. I was excited that the first story they were telling didn't feel the need to do tons of origin stuff about everybody. It let the story tell a lot of it. And I'm really happy that it did not make the first movie be a romance about Star-Lord getting the girl or whatever. I think that was pretty important. And it's let the characters have space. And one thing that I keep thinking about is, it's, you know, the mother character, right? Star-Lord's mother. Like, excuse me.
Oh.
It'd be really easy to look at her as being like another sort of absent female victim. But she's actually super present throughout the movie because she created the soundtracks that are used throughout. And those soundtracks are so key to the movie. They bring a lot of joy to the film and energy. I bet they're going to make a lot of money selling the soundtracks. I'm sure there are going to be a ton of young people who are going to suddenly like have a David Bowie song that they never heard of before going on their Spotify accounts. And his mother, as you learn in the end, since she, you know, totally did it with an alien, is clearly an interesting and rebellious person in her own right. And I hope that we get to learn a little bit more of her story in the next film, which wouldn't surprise me since I think they're going to try to go into his origins a bit more there. But I think it's a nice touch to have the mother be present, the dead mother be present in those ways.
I'd agree with that, absolutely. And it was nice to see a significant female character who was not involved in any way, shape, or form with the refrigerator. But she was actually, yeah, like you said, like an absent presence throughout the entire film. Because Chris Pratt was playing as Star-Lord, a wounded man-child. But instead of it being the sort of typical wounded man-child who, you know, has these daddy issues or mommy issues, it was actually a traumatic event. And it reminded me, the opening 5 minutes reminded me a lot of, it was that Disney movie with the ship, Flight of the Navigator?
Navigator,
where the kid went away for like 17 years and then came back and his parents had forgotten him, but he was abducted, and I think that's what it was. But It was a very traumatic film for me as a child because it was entirely about coming back and having your parents, like, forget you. And every time, you know, the babysitter fell asleep on the couch and my parents weren't home, I would just sit there saying, are they coming back? Is this it? Like, am I on my own now? And so that was always a very powerful thing for me. And so just watching him, like, run away. And, in fact, when I was watching it with my wife, she turned to me and she looked at me like, I thought we were here to see a fun science fiction film. What the fuck is going on? Like, because those first 10 minutes are actually legitimately moving. And then the silliness. However, but I'm stepping on people's toes here, so I will shut up.
Oh, no, no. I'm just clearing my throat because I'm ill, so you should continue talking.
Well, I know Brett's going to rain our parade, so we should get this all out now.
Yeah. Let me dump on it, and then we can get it,
and
we can move on. All right. So I am a bit more mixed than everyone else. for me, the I'll first say is my I think the crown jewel of Marvel's movies, and I'm counting Marvel movies from Iron Man on, and not counting the Sony and Fox stuff, is Winter Soldier. I think that movie showed that you could do smart, intelligent action films with comic book characters. Guardians to me felt more like a throwback to the first Iron Man in quality of some of the visuals, the storytelling, and it also seemed to be very Disney-fied at moments. A lot of things were dumbed down. Instead of letting the audience figure it out, it was just spelled out there, especially at the end, is what really kind of drove me on the top, over the top on that one. Some stuff I loved, like I loved Chris Pratt. He played Star-Lord perfect. It's exactly how I envision him in the comics. Vin Diesel, even though he just said "I am Groot" over and over and over again, was really good. And shockingly, Bradley Cooper, like, I forgot it was Bradley Cooper doing Rocket.
Oh, he owned that, yeah.
Yeah, like, when you hear an animated voice and you totally forget who's behind it, like, they've done a good job. Dave Bautista, I mean, the guy's a wrestler. I didn't really expect much from him, but Drax, he was good. Like, he, you know, wasn't great, wasn't bad. He just, he played the character as what the character probably should be.
I think he was great.
No,
there
Drax
was a lot
was
of
excellent.
Great physical comedy with him.
Yeah.
A lot of wonderful reaction shots. I mean, the Groot dancing at the end, I mean, that was a brilliantly played physical bit of physical comedy. I mean, I'm giving him his props.
All right. Zoe Saldana, I thought was a little bit, other than those, I felt a lot of the other characters were very either miscast or bland. Zoe Saldana as Gamora, while I generally love the character, I just thought her delivery and her acting was kind of a little subpar. Lee Pace, who's normally, I think, a brilliant actor and catching, what was it, Catching Fire? What was the show? Halt and Catch Fire. He was brilliant in that. He just chewed the scenery as Ronan, and as a whole, like, Ronan's story made very little sense. Kieran Gillen just kind of stood there and jutted out her pip. And then you had all these, like, big names like Jimin Hansu, John C. Reilly, Glenn Close, Michael Rooker, Benicio Del Toro, which I'm wondering what Marvel has on them that got them in the film, because as a whole, it was fairly underused. Big names for, like, very small characters. But as a whole, like, I just thought, like, the plot was very bland. We've kind of seen it. We've done it. The end of the movie had the Marvel sacrifice of the characters. I just felt like we've seen it before. And overall, like, my vibe of the film was this was a move the overall story of Thanos along, as opposed to Thanos being the small part of the story and this being its own thing that could stand its own. It was fun. Like, a lot of it was fun. There's stuff like the Nowhere and, you know, the Tease of Cosmo and, I mean, there was tons to that I liked, but the other stuff that I disliked was just so overwhelmingly that I disliked it, it kind of drew me out of the film. That's my rant.
See, well, what I would say is that I went into it very excited. This was the film this summer that I was looking most forward to seeing, and in part because James Gunn did such a wonderful job with a very thinly premised movie, Slither, with Nathan Fillion a couple of years ago, and I do love his stuff, and so when I was going to this really excited, and what really struck me is it's weird that you're talking about all your disappointments with all these things, because when I exited the film for the first time, this is the first thing in ages. The only thing that seems comparable to me in recent time would be something like The Fifth Element, that's not that recent, or Stargate, where I actually left the theater with that almost childlike wonder. And there, the moments, you know, it's not just Nowhere. It's also Groot making fireflies or whatever he made out of his arm, and just lighting it all up and the way that they played the scene and just sort of let it breathe. You know, it wasn't a forced action film. It was actually a brilliant little moment of allowing the little lights to float in the air and then, of course, having the witty line to sort of, you know, cut through the cheese. But it was – I actually was genuinely moved when I saw things like that in the way that my 8-year-old self would have been. And I think that overwhelmed a lot of the qualms, at least for me, the qualms that you're having with plot points or Thanos not really making sense, Ronan not really making sense. But, I mean, honestly, like, the first time you watched Star Wars, did it make sense? Or was it just...
Star Wars to me made sense. I remember that wonder of Star Wars.
The first time you saw the X-Wings flying towards the Death Star and they open up just ever so slightly, and you know, I was, I guess, 6 years old when I saw that. And my, you know, as those little X-Wings open up, my brain sort of opened up too. I was like, whoa, this is, and I could just imagine, like, being a little kid watching Guardians of the Galaxy, and when I saw it on Saturday, the audience was full of little kids who were actually fucking quiet. They were watching this movie. They weren't talking. They weren't screaming. They were... So maybe it's a little dumbed down, but maybe it's just creating a whole bunch of new science fiction fans, which I have to
that
say...
That I totally agree
I'm
with.
Totally for.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, this is... And I hear it over and over and over again. This is the next generation Star Wars. I fully believe that. And then with that, I also accept that maybe the film wasn't geared towards me as much as it was towards them, which is fine. But yeah, I mean, I see it's weird. I didn't get that. I'm trying to think of like that last movie I had a really huge sense of wonder in. It wasn't this, but there was one and I'm driving me nuts trying to remember what it was. I'll think of it.
Another big moment for me, and it wasn't a movie, but it was on television, was, if you ever watch Stargate Universe, there's an episode where they end up having to dive into the sun. And in an ancient ship that they don't know it's going to survive the journey, and it's this beautiful thing. So, you know, which connects to another one of my favorite films, the Danny Boyle film, Sunshine, you know, which was just, right, it turned terrible towards the end, but the first half of the film, brilliant. But these just big galactic stories that don't actually care if the audience is understanding them. And, I mean, the obvious, even without going to Karen Gillan, like, the obvious analog is Doctor Who. Stories that make no sense, that rely on the charm of a single actor and sort of barrel forward through absurdity. This has a lot in common with that, I think. Maybe it's just
yeah,
me, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, I agree.
No, I agree.
I completely go with that.
Yeah, nowhere could just be the you know, the Reformed New Catholic Church cyborg artificial intelligence. But sorry, I'm talking too much, so please go ahead.
No. Definitely.
Okay, well I can just keep this up all night. I have this whole spiel about how Groot is essentially Harpo Marx. And I'm gonna dig into
that.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
that's
when Groot, when Groot embraced everyone in his body with the, and light, like you said, that was this, like, magical moment and this, like, self-sacrifice, and it was deeply moving, and it was, like, visually beautiful.
It was gorgeously shot. Unlike a lot of the action sequences, which were just chaotic and you couldn't make sense of, but that's all movies these days. We've talked about this with Winter Soldier, like, yeah, people just don't direct those very well anymore. But yeah, when Groot was actually enveloping all of them, and you know you're being played, and I think it's actually the sign of a really great sentimental filmmaker. When you know you're being played, and your heartstrings are being plucked, and yet, despite all you know all of our irony and all of our you're still sort of moved, and it's like I'm getting a little teary eyed about this tree. Sentient tree.
It made me want to go plant trees, I'll tell you that. Yeah, I mean, the movie did that really well. Like, even the beginning. Like, the beginning, I will admit, I was tearing up with you know, Chris Pratt or Star-Lord and the scene with his mother. Like, I think that was really, really well done, and the comedic timing between Rocket and Groot was fantastic. I mean, that's, I think, the thing that got me the most about the movie. There was so much that was done that was so right. And then there was just all these little small things that kept on needling me. It's interesting. Like, definitely visually, like, I think Gunn nailed it. Like, he really got that movie down, the look of it. The thing I still can't figure out is how everyone went into it being like, oh, this is a risky film. You know, this is a long shot for Marvel. Like, this was a no-brainer, it being successful.
Oh, no. I think it's absolutely a long shot. I mean, giving basically an unproven director $170 million to make a movie with no established characters in which the lead's most notable role, and which, granted, for people like me and a lot of sort of, you know, TV viewers who have sort of feminist inclinations, like, the idea of giving Chris Pratt a leading role in movies is actually, that makes perfect sense. But for a film executive, we're going to give Chris Pratt his own star vehicle and spend $170 million on it. I think it was absolutely a risk, especially what was the last big outer space film that has... I mean, and actually, we talked about you suffering through Green Lantern. And I think from a studio executive point of view, this looked a lot like Green Lantern. Right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I know this is going to sound crazy, but my hatred of the Green Lantern film comes from the fact that total lack of imagination. You can do anything with the ring and you make a giant machine gun. But I don't think the Green Lantern film...
Well, that's partially Hal Jordan's fault.
Yeah. He is sort of an idiot and a dick. But
thank you.
I mean, that film I don't think was anywhere nearly bad as people thought it was. I think it's just the lack of imagination really hit home because of the choices that the Hal Jordan character made in the film. And this, though, I think it had the same sort of wide canvas and the same giant scope. And I could see people saying, I mean, in fact, what was it, like 2 weeks ago, DC came out, or one of the DC executives actually came out and said that, you know, the whole reason that we're being very careful with the Superman franchise is because, you know, we got fucked by Green Lantern. And they actually said that was the reason that we're toning down the whole Superman's an alien thing, which, you know, of course, I think ruins the character, but Zack Snyder would do that anyway. But this was just, you know, you're going to give us a bunch of money, we're going to make this movie. And sure, a lot of it doesn't make sense. And sure, it's sort of obvious the points where it's connecting up with the other Marvel franchises. But at the same time, again, my wife, who has not seen The Avengers, she has not seen Winter Soldier, she hasn't seen any of the comic book movies coming from the Marvel franchise, she loved it. And I think it says a lot, because it stands on its own. And I sort of wonder if the second film might actually suffer, because it's going to fall right back into the, oh, you haven't watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., so therefore you're not going to understand what's going on in here, right? Or you haven't watched Agent Carter or, you know, Daredevil or Iron Fist and all of the other ones that they're doing, right? This was a standalone film, I think. I'll argue. If someone disagrees with me.
I would say the film... definitely can stand on its own, but when you put it in that big perspective, I felt a lot of the choices and what was being done was just to move the greater narrative along, as opposed to the small little hints here and there in other films where they tease you with it. Like, it was just blatant. Like, so yeah, we'll go straight in the spoiler. So there's the scene with Ronan and Thanos, and you know, Rodan's like, you're going to help me go and do this and go attack the Nova Corps and all them. And Thanos is there. But for me, I didn't really get that motivation of, like, why Ronan wanted to do this, other than that he was still pissed off from the war. But the bigger is, like, it was just like Thanos was there, what, twice for 2 seconds, and it just felt, like, forced in there of, like, hey, we're going to remind you of this. That it ties into all this, and we're going to have this MacGuffin of the jewel of one of the Infinity Gems, but we're going to totally ignore that. You know, Ronan probably knows what these things are. Why wouldn't he just keep it for himself to begin with? And why did he even need Thanos? when he could just go do it himself. I mean, like, it was just felt very, they forced a lot of stuff in. They tied it a bit, almost too much into the, what was going on before with not maybe explaining some stuff. And then they over-explained other things. It's one of those, it's just like that. So many small, to me, it was those details. I was like, you could either overlook them, which is totally fine. But I got bogged down in it. And it just pulled me out of it.
Go up your own damn
I mean, you're right. None of that made any sense. I just didn't care. I normally do care. So that's sort
that's
of says something.
Crazy. Yeah.
But
at the same time, I mean, Hitler isn't in Raiders of the Lost Ark, but you still understand what the Nazis are doing.
this is true, yes.
Right. I mean, it's. I mean, Thanos appears more. I mean, well, okay, Hitler is in Last Crusade for like 10 seconds, but you don't really need the Overlord in order to understand what the minions are up to, and to have a big, giant, universally nefarious plot sort of pushing forward. But I think I cut you off, so I'll.
No, that was it. Sorry, go ahead.
I was saying, is there like Ronan's? Like motivation or what plot he wants to do is exactly what Loki was going to do, is like, you know, attack and invade this planet. The difference is that Ronan wanted to destroy it, Loki wanted to enslave it. They each kind of had their like pseudo armies to help him with it. Like in the beginning,
but you know,
when Ronan's
in comics, people try to destroy Earth. That's like what happens.
This is true.
And in fact, to go way into spoilers, like that is Star-Lord's father, who's the president and. Of the universe, he bans people from going to Earth in order to invite them to attack Earth. So this is I don't really have a problem with everyone wants to attack Earth because it's somehow special. That's sort of a motivating force in the Marvel universe. The whole
right.
I mean, granted, they're not going to be able to talk about mutants, but that is the driving force behind why all of these outer space races are. Even give a shit about Earth.
Yeah, that I mean, they do. In the comics, basically, Earth is basically like this, really the center of the universe, which is hilarious when you want to look at it in so many other ways.
It's clearly such a backwater compared to so many other places, yeah.
Yeah.
But we have mutants, people who can. And they're very specific in the comics. So, you know, they actually talk specifically about Magneto in the 2013-14 Guardians of the Galaxy and saying they're having a conversation about people who could really, you know, tear shit up. And they're like, yeah, there's this one guy, Magneto. But, of course, they can't go into that in the Marvel movies. But or the Marvel Studio movies.
Yes.
But, I mean, I'm sort of okay with that even as a sort of motivating plot factor, because that's sort of even – most science fiction is still anthropocentric in that respect, that we might not be alone in the universe, but we're special, damn it. The only exception I could think of would be like Ian M. Banks' culture novels, where we really are like late to the party, you know, just sort of showing up, getting our, you know, all of these things implanted in us and trying to catch up with the rest of the galaxy. But
it's really hard for us to decenter ourselves in the narrative. I'm not surprised.
We're a bunch of narcissistic motherfuckers, and I say that as, you know, a consummate narcissist. But, could you imagine, like, a radically inhuman science fiction film that would also be successful?
No, because people wouldn't watch it.
It would be Howard the Duck.
Speaking of cameos.
It would be something like that, like, Or it'd be like Watchmen from the perspective of the, you know, created giant squid tentacle thing. Like, it'd be really interesting. And don't get me wrong, like, as a sci-fi fan, I would love that. I would love to actually have, like, a movie where it's really from the perspective of an alien anthropologist examining the Earth. But I don't think I'm ever going to see that movie, unfortunately. So your haters.
Oh, I have a little story I have to tell really quick.
Okay.
I actually met James Gunn at a fan con in Virginia in 1996 when he was there to promote Romeo and Juliet.
Wow.
He was wearing a suit that was too large for him. I have a distinct recollection of that. That's all I have to say for myself.
Chris Pratt once retweeted something
what.
I tweeted. So I have that, but
yeah,
he retweeted everything. Yeah.
I knew him when.
Yeah. And Chris Pratt is a tweet slut. If you draw a picture of Chris Pratt dressed up as Star-Lord and tweet it to him, he will retweet it. I'm not saying I did that, and there's no proof that I did. So anyway, we were saying something else?
I did love Chris Pratt in the film. I think he was perfect in that role. Like, I can't think of anyone else who would played it as well as he would have, because he seems to have mastered the man-child in a way, that character, though Star-Lord's a little bit of a twist on it. But yeah, he absolutely rocked that role. I give him massive credit for it.
And I'll say, I'm a huge Parks and Rec fan, and the way that he kept that sort of insouciant, like, not innocent, but sort of, I'm just charming enough, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's all of his interactions on Parks and Rec with what's her name, Aubrey Plaza, right? They're all borderline sociopathic, like when he's hiding in the dumpster, jumping in and out of it, claiming to have found his wallet and or is looking for noodles, which he finds, of course, in the dumpster. And it is man-child, but at the same time, there's a logic to it. And what I know this is going to sound crazy, but what I always associate with him in Parks and Rec is this is what Calvin would have been like if he grew up. Right? If Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes, like when he got older and was still emotionally invested in his imagination. So all of the Burt Macklin FBI stuff, all of the – and so a lot of the movie seems a lot like Spaceman Spiff to me. Like this is Calvin all grown up being played by, you know, by Pratt in this big budget movie. And I guess this is part of the reason why I'm such a sucker for it, because it's like it's hitting all of my favorite – both childhood and then sort of feminist television watching and all of the, like, it's hitting all of my notes, right? And I just wanted Hobbs. But you know, I'm okay. I can't ask everything from a movie.
Do you have any particular visual rhetoric points?
Oh, I have a lot. Well, I mentioned the Harpo Marx thing earlier.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, so the scene where Rocket / Chico Marx is explaining what needs to be done. And Groot,
oh my God, that's so
in
true.
The prison. And Groot is behind him actually doing it silently. There's a scene in Animal Crackers where Chico is running a peanut booth. And he's explaining all of the reasons he can't be doing something. And Harpo silently behind him is actually doing everything that apparently cannot be done. And then the scene ends with Harpo actually, like, giving the peanuts to the guy, and then Chico looking at him and going, and, you know, what are you talking about? I'm not going to try to do a Chico Marx, but okay, I just did. But it's that sort of old-school physical comedy, and but not just old-school. It's that sort of intelligent physical comedy between the overly talkative, ostensible lead and the background character. I mean, there were times when I just expected, and I swear to God, I'm not like a 70-year-old Jew who's just talking about Marx Brothers films. I'm actually only in my 30s.
Well,
but,
if you were,
but,
you would be really welcome on this show.
Oh,
and but this analogy is like dead on.
Yeah, I mean, half the time Groot's arm went down, I expected spoons and forks to fall out of it. Like, I mean, it was, you know, it was just such. It was a Chico and Harpo routine for most of the film, right down to, you know, Groot's big eyes looking and Groot, like, trying to help everyone. That's Harpo. And so visually, James Gunn, I don't have, like, outside, you know, corroboration of this, but I guarantee that a lot of those scenes that between Rocket and Groot were based on, or at least somewhere in his mind, they were blocked in such a way that they do sort of resemble these old Marx Brothers routines, because it had that both sort of funny, witty, but at the same time, oddly moving. Like, this guy seems really dumb, and yet he always seems to do the right thing. And then a hot dog ball
with
that. But, I mean, I could talk a lot about the visual rhetoric of it. I mean, there were a friend of mine who's a big gamer was talking about how this movie looked like what he thought the PS4 would be like. It looked like a really great video game. And he didn't mean this as an insult, because he'd been playing, Last of Us. And so he was very much in the mindset, and he was thinking about, because he had just finished it on the PS3, and he was thinking about what it was going to be like on the upgraded PS4 version. And then he saw this, and he's like, this is what I want, like, and I think what he was getting at was that it created a world that was totally improbable and yet absolutely believable. It had just enough dirt and grime, right? Like the scenes, you know, in the bar, and you know when Drax gets drunk and then he threatens Ronan, like there's actual mud flying around there. And if you compare that to, say, you know, Brana's version of the Nevada Desert in the Thor movie, which was like almost pristine, it looked like a set. And then the giant metal thing looked like a gleam. I mean, it looked like a video game in a bad way. This looked like a video game in a great immersive way. And on rewatching the film, I kept noticing more little details. I'm not saying it's Blade Runner or anything, but it was much closer to Blade Runner than it is to mostly the Marvel Universe films in terms of creating a believable alternative world. And don't even get me started on Thor: The Dark World, because Jesus. but there was, I mean, and now I really feel like I'm hogging. I think I'm doing like 90% of the talking here, and that's not fair to y'all. So I will shut up. But ask me more about the visual stuff later, and I will continue to chime in.
Okay. No, we really appreciate this. We like having guests so you can talk about stuff that, you know, might not have necessarily come from either of your regular hosts. And also, I can't stop coughing uncontrollably, so no need to apologize.
I'll throw out a question. Oh,
yeah.
Go ahead. I'll save my question.
One thing I was going to make sure people knew, because I did not know this, is that the screenwriter, Nicole Perlman, is a lady, and there's an interesting story about how she ended up writing the script. She was chosen for a pilot project of science for writers to do scripts for Marvel, and they had a number of different properties you could choose from between. And Guardians of the Galaxy was her first pick. She, like, was a huge sci-fi geek and a big science nerd. And, of course, like, they were basically like, nah, you don't want to do that. You're a girl. You want to do one of the other stories, clearly. And so I thought that was really interesting.
And Gunn has taken a lot of flack for not acknowledging her contribution to the script enough. And I actually think a lot of that is misplaced, because I've seen a number of interviews with him where he talks about how her script, even though it was not the final script, because there was a lot of ad-libbing on set. I've talked to some of the people who were there, and they said that there was a lot of the banter that you see is actually the actors improvising, you know, in the moment.
Sure.
But and if you've ever watched any of the behind-the-scenes things from Parks and Rec, you know exactly the moments I'm talking about, and Chris Pratt sort of led the, I think I called him Andy Pratt either. He's in my mind, he's Dwyer Pratt, whatever. But Chris Pratt, actually, you can sort of see him leading this sort of improv. But that actually comes from this whole feminist pedagogy thing that Amy Poehler does that Pratt has totally bought into in terms of how to get things written. Beside the point, I think Gunn has done a marvelous job acknowledging Perlman's, like, just the fact that she opened up his mind to the fact that this was a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And she, without her, none of this would have been possible. And he said this on numerous occasions. And I've read some stuff online where people say he's not giving her enough credit. And I think if you excerpt any part of any interview, yes, it looks like he's not giving her enough credit. But he's already asked her to work on the script for the next film. And he seems to be very sort of open about saying, Like, look, this is what we need in comic films, a new, fresh voice. And he doesn't actually come out and say, female, we need, like, Jesus Christ, people, half of our audience are lady folk. Maybe we should, you know, have that perspective.
She is the only woman who has a writing credit on a
Marvel Cinematic Universe
project, yes.
But he's been really good about acknowledging her contribution, and good for him and good for her, because I think this film kind of shows what happens when you have that, you know, sort of. I keep on going back to feminist pedagogy because I'm writing a thing about how Parks and Rec is actually directed, so I keep on going back to the Amy Poehler thing, but. Like the Kevin Bacon stuff was ad-libbed by Chris Pratt, and Zoe Saldana ad-libbed right back at him. That for me was like one of the best moments in the entire film. Right, the tale of the Kevin Bacon, you know. And as my wife said, like after we left the movie, she's like, "Could you imagine what it would have been like to have actually been Kevin Bacon sitting in the theater when that conversation took place? Like, that would that be like the highest point of your life or the lowest?" Like, but you know, I really hope they continue to go in this direction of being more open and you know, letting the lady folk write some things, because I mean, honestly, I don't want to see another Iron Man film at this point. Like, I just, it's turned into a not just one very masculine voice, but one masculine voice and his 90,000 masculine voice puppets who are all flying around at the same time. That was just sort of the nadir of the Marvel Universe for me at this point, is that last Iron Man movie. It's not enough to have one drunken, masculine, handsome, charming man. You must have a flying army of them. Oh, really?
Oh, and you know, and do folks remember back in, what was it, 20... Actually, I'm only knowing the states because I just looked through the search. In 2012... James Gunn came under a lot of criticism because of some seriously effed up shit he said on the internet, which kind of broke my heart, but didn't surprise me. So I'm quite edified that he handled the movie as well as he did, and that he's, you know, promoting the female screenwriter, and, you know, the actual output is good.
I mean, if we wanted to knock him, we could say that, well, of course he's going to promote her because he's very invested in making another movie as good as this one, so it's obviously his best interest financially to promote her contribution to it. I don't really necessarily want to be that cynical, though, given how few opportunities there are to sort of be non-cynical about the participation of women in comic book franchises.
Yeah.
But maybe that's just me wish-casting on this, and it isn't really reflective of reality. But I can see an argument being made that this is just him being selfish. I don't know if I don't agree with that at all, but I'm just sort of throwing it out there.
And his apology was like, his apology was less shitty than most. So,
but Twitter makes everyone shitty. I mean, every single time I read anything about Twitter or write about anything about Twitter for the Raw Story, all I could think is, "Wow, you all look like shit." And
it wasn't a Twitter thing.
Oh, it wasn't a Twitter thing?
No, but I forgive you for thinking it was.
Oh, I thought you said it was.
No,
I'm sorry.
No.
That's my mistake. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't even remember what the specifics were of what the issue was.
He had written, there was like a list on the site that people were voting on, like the sexiest superhero characters, and his comment on Batwoman was, this lesbian character was voted for almost exclusively by men, which surprises me, says Ilana, as a side note. I don't know exactly what that means, but I'm hoping for a Marvel-DC crossover so that Tony Stark can, quote, turn her. She could also have sex with Nightwing and probably still be technically considered a lesbian. So that was his comment.
Ooh, that's awful, actually.
Yeah.
That's homophobic and misogynistic. That's really terrible.
Yep.
Well, now
but
I feel like an asshole for
supporting
him a second ago, but that is awful. Can we just say it was on Twitter and pretend it didn't happen? No. wow, that really does.
No, it happens, and I was worried about the movie for that reason. you know, people, as soon as the ads began playing in the theaters, everybody was asking me, like, Ilana, have you heard about the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie? Is it going to be good? It looks like it's going to be good. Should we see it? And I had this moment of saying, like, well, you know, this internet thing,
it's ruining our lives.
But I definitely didn't see sex.
But thank you for listening to the podcast.
Wait, what?
I said this internet is ruining our lives, but thank you for listening to the podcast. The only thing I'll say about that is maybe Karen Gillan is just really good with working with directors who are not the most progressive when it comes to feminist issues. I mean, she worked with Moffat for 3 years.
I was going to say, Moffat, enough said.
I mean...
Oh, people really liked her in this movie, but I thought she didn't do anything. Really?
I felt she was really underused, other than standing there and, like, jutting out her hip every so often.
Yeah.
To me, like, that, I think that she's the prime example of underused.
Well, no. The prime example of underused is going to be her in that new series with the remake of My Fair Lady, where the whole point of the series is going to be to remove her Scottish accent. What the fuck is wrong with people?
Yeah.
Like, Yeah, that's. I mean, come on. Like, if you hire Karen Gillan, you do it because you want that presence that she has. And I think you're right. That she was totally underutilized in the film because, I mean, you want that energy that even Stephen Moffat's terrible misogynistic dialogue couldn't wholly repress, right? You know. Then again, she did look like the TARDIS. I mean, there's that. I don't know. I was really underwhelmed by her, too, and disappointed, because I really like Amy Pond.
Yeah.
But only because I want to be her. So I guess I really like Matt Smith. That makes it even... anyway.
That's
so
awesome.
I also like Long Walks on the Beach. And anyway... So someone, okay, that was like 8 notes to please someone stop me. So talk about something else.
I'm thinking that we need to debate about Selfie at some point or whatever the hell that show is called.
What show?
The Kieran Gillan one. It's a whole other tangent. We don't need to discuss it.
It's the remake of My Fair Lady with Harold from Harold and Kumar. And
yeah.
It's all about denuding her of everything that makes her interesting. It's really awful.
She's
wonderful in it.
I thought
and
it was
that
cute.
Just makes it
yeah.
worse.
She is fantastic in it. That's the interesting thing.
But the entire show is about how do we make this like vibrant, alive woman into a boring blonde. I mean, that's the entire premise of the show, and it's just... But I will say, it has a non-white male lead, which mm-hmm. I think is, you know, Don Cho, I like that. I like the writing team that they have behind it. It's just the show itself is just wrong. But that's for another episode of this.
Yes, we could have a whole discussion about prior. Yeah. We'll do TV season at some point.
Hey, as long as they'll keep inviting me back, I'll keep showing up.
I'm game for TV scene. I've watched all of ABC stuff, so I'm geared to go.
I don't know. I only watch cartoons, guys. But you know that by now.
We'll wait for one that you can't do, and then we'll do the TV season.
Okay. Well, by the way, I did just discover BoJack Horseman, which I'm enjoying quite a bit.
Oh, no, that is quite wonderful. Thank you, Netflix.
Cartoon. Yeah, Netflix cartoon. Good. Well, what are the other... I want more visual rhetoric stuff. Give me more visual rhetoric stuff.
Okay, well, I already mentioned that the fight scenes are just as terrible as they are in basically every other modern film, with the exception of the one between Drax and Ronan, because that one was actually much worse, because they were trying to, and we sort of complimented the film for giving space to characterization and allowing people to, but what that turned into was this weird exposition where Drax was telling Ronan exactly why he was And it was the most awfully and awkwardly paced fight scene I've seen in a long time. And they kept cutting away from it. It's almost as if Gunn was, like, editing it together, and he let it go for, like, 10 seconds and was like, oh, fuck, this is bad. Let's go back to the pod racing I have going up. Not pod racing, but the mining bubble racing. And then he cut back to it, but it's like he didn't want to be there. It was like it was so bad. And as great as Drax was in the film, you know, with the physical comedy, with the dancing Groot, with the, I think, the, one of the most memorable moments in the film, when Rocket talks about how his people are literal, and Drax responds by, you know, saying, nothing flies over my head. I mean, those were beautiful moments. But, man, it's terrible. That fight scene with Ronan, because all Drax is doing is hitting him and getting thrown down. And I can see what the point was in Gunn's head.
I thought that was the point.
Well, yeah, to demonstrate that as strong as Drax is, Ronan is a being of another level, which is something you have to do in a film where the differences between races are going to be so vast that you just have to understand that this is sort of a flea fighting, you know, an elephant. But it was just done so clumsily, like almost like he didn't want to do it. Like he felt he was wasting all of the time he had spent earlier in the film, especially in the prison scenes, building Drax the Destroyer up as this sort of physical specimen. He thought it would be ruined by the Ronin, so he kept cutting away from it. And even when he was cutting close to it, he was doing a lot of the, you know, the typical, like, elbow to face to elbow to knee to ground to head to, like, where the body is broken up to the parts that are being hurt at any given point in time. And I really think that detracted. It would have been much better to have actually just shown, you know, to use a long shot and had Drax run up at Ronan once and have Ronan flatten him. And then just hung the camera there. There were so many moments that they let the movie breathe and actually extended a shot longer than I thought they would a take, you know, to like 45 seconds where any other film would be like 20.
I think your point about letting the film breathe is a really good one.
Yeah, but they didn't do it here, and I think it would have been really, in the same way that the opening sequence, you know, was so sort of open and allowed you to sort of get into, Chris Pratt's character's head, if they just let Drax say his piece to Ronan, run at him, and have Ronan flatten him, and then just leave the camera there for another, like, 5 or 6 seconds, and then cut back to the, you know, exciting mining race. I think that scene would have been brilliant. But I don't know if he could have sold that.
I was going to say, is that Gunn's fault, or is it whoever does the fight?
That's a directing thing.
Well, it's the director and editor. I mean, it's going to be them deciding together how they want to actually cut the footage that he shot. And he clearly had both a medium long shot and an extreme long shot of that fight sequence because they included both in the rapidly edited final product. But I think it would have been best as sort of an extreme long shot and just let it happen and just let it happen quick and then linger on the after effects.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have just been much more evocative for Drax. And going back to what you were saying earlier about how this film felt like it was sort of dumbed down playing to kids, I called them pods because I'm getting a lot of the pod racing thing, and I think that scene was unnecessarily long and unnecessarily complicated, and it was very much geared toward a younger audience, and that did not instill a science fiction sense of wonder in me. It made me think, wow, this is very busy, and a lot of stuff is happening that I don't understand. And, oh, wait, now they're in space. But it didn't until they let it breathe after Chris Pratt leaves his little bubble, goes to Zozana, and then they're both floating there in space, slowly freezing to death. And then they, you know, of course, the obvious reference point for that would be like the, you know, Titanic, Jack and Rose.
I go abyss on that one.
Hmm?
I felt it was a lot like The Abyss when was it McDowell? Was it Andy McDowell? Winds up drowning.
We're still in James Cameron territory, though.
Yeah.
Titanic or The Abyss.
True.
Right. We're both in that James Cameron, and he does it. I mean, he does it again in Aliens. All of those long, quiet moments. You know, they mostly come in at night. Mostly, right? There are a lot of those moments in Aliens where he lets the film breathe. That's sort of a classic Cameron technique until he got to Avatar, in which case all the blue people just like threw shit at each other. But I really like that part of it. But the sort of jammed together like bad George Lucas shit, I could have done without. That said, I don't. Do you remember that old movie Glory that starred Andre Brauer and some guy named Denzel? When the Nova Corps like banded together to try to stop the giant slinky from attacking the giant black slinky thing, I found myself unusually moved by that, by this sort of, in a sort of socialist way. Like, this seemed like either good old-fashioned socialist cinema or something like The End of Glory, which if you haven't seen, I'll spoil it for you. All the black people die, but nobly and for a good cause. And that sort of last-ditch effort, you know, that we will stand against the oncoming, I was about to say oncoming sword, but that would be weird, struck by Doctor Who earlier. But I will stand against the wave of evil. And I found that like really moving, even though that scene was...
It was really moving. And I thought the way they went to different characters and you saw the different people, I thought it was well done.
And to go back to what I was saying earlier about the Two Towers, it reminded me a lot of the scene in the Two Towers where the elves are finally like, okay, we give a shit. We'll come here, we'll help you. You know, when they march up to Helm's Deep and are like, yeah, okay, we're here, reinforcements. And part of me could have swore that it was the same fucking actor, but it wasn't. I looked it up. It's just another sort of British guy who seems like he belongs in Lord of the Rings. But no, it was a tremendously moving moment, and then when Rocket went down and was like, all right, just shoot up, as the suicide bombers started, you know, attacking the Capitol, and it's like, I'm really glad I'm not a political scientist, and I don't have to like justify my emotional responses to all of these different things, like, because we have the suicide bombers being stopped by the people shooting up, we have the self-sacrifice above. It's like, this is an ideological mess, but it's moving cinema. Now I'm just giving people things to argue about, like later on they can totally troll the podcast and be like, what the fuck, Kaufman? The Nova Corps isn't a socialist organization. I think it is.
Yeah.
It kind of is. Oh, it very much is. Well, hey, so speaking of the Nova Corps, like, what do you think of the changes that they had about the Nova Corps compared to the comic?
There were certainly a lot more of them.
Yeah.
It was much less centered on a singular figure. And I think the Nova Corps, I mean, if you think about it sort of structurally, it functioned in the film the same way that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was functioning in the other Marvel properties.
Mm-hmm.
As the, we are the faceless, nameless, even though they're not neither faceless nor nameless, We're the people you don't see. We're the little people getting crushed, who, if we band together, we can do just as much as that guy with that hammer, right? And so that's sort of how the core felt to me, and it felt to me like the proxy for S.H.I.E.L.D., or whatever S.H.I.E.L.D. is now, you know, after Winter Soldier and such. But I like the fact, because going into the movie, I was certain after reading things on Twitter and that Nathan Fillion would be playing Nova, and I was glad to see that was not the case, because, one, we all know Nathan Fillion, he needs to be Green Lantern. But all saw that cut.
No, you don't cast a comic actor as Green Lantern. We've already learned that you shouldn't do that.
I don't know. Wait, is Ryan Reynolds, does he count as a comic actor?
He's a bad actor, but he
is considered a comic actor. Okay, well, I don't, but anyway, I'm glad they did not cast Fillion as Nova, which is what they sort of led. Apparently he was in the film. I've now seen it three times. I can't figure out who the fuck he's supposed to be in the film.
He is the alien, the big alien that confronts him in the jail.
The big blue one?
I think he was blue, yeah.
Yeah, the big blue one.
They wind up beating down.
Yeah, okay, well, that's sort of what I eventually thought, but it wasn't distinctive enough. He needed to say the verse at some point, and then I would have been like, okay, you're... I needed a less subtle in-joke. But I thought the core was handled really well. And the selflessness of their sacrifice, I thought, was done, especially, and as anyone who grew up, like, watching Star Wars, the idea of being crushed to death is, like, ingrained in me as, like, my worst fear, you know, because of the trash compactor. So when he was getting crushed, right, I looked away and was like, and teared up a little bit, but, you know, just sort of, it resonated with me. And of course, the way that they kept on going, not to the fake Star Wars movies that George Lucas made in the 90s, but the actual one from where Lucas and Kazan would cut directly into the cockpit during scenes, so you could see people talking, versus what he did in the prequel, which is just lots of like things flying around and voices being heard, and then occasionally Ewan McGregor pops up, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of close-ups of the people in the ships, and I think it's really important in terms of having an emotional connection to these characters, actually going inside and seeing their fear, their pain, as opposed to turning it totally into a video game where there are 9,000 starships flying around randomly and you don't give a shit, right? And they emphasize that a couple times with Rocket especially, where the camera basically flies into his mouth as he's yelling, flying towards the camera, which is, of course, all CGI, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, as for all the 2 seconds that he's in the film, you know, everyone can name Porkins in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it's because he actually has an emotional moment. It might have been 15 seconds, but he's got a moment you remember.
And the camera's right up in his face, and you actually... You know, stay on target, stay on target. You know, I mean, and then when it goes, it's this, and Lucas, he used to be so fucking brilliant with sound direction. He used to be genius with orchestrating the sound in his films. It blows up silently, right? And it's not actually an X-Wing. It's one of those ones with the long legs behind it. And it as it sort of explodes and you're like,
is it the B-Wing, or did they just make that up so I buy the toy? Does it work?
Well, both, probably, but it was...
Yeah, wasn't there
was
some grand conspiracy on the B-Wing?
Yeah, the long tubes coming out of the back. Looks sort of like a...
Y-Wing.
Yeah. It looks like
a Y.
It looks more like a Y than a B.
Wait, Frank says I'm wrong? The Y-Wing is not the B-Wing?
The B-Wing was the long one.
And what about the A-Wing?
No, A-Wing's the small one.
Oh, man, why are my nerd friends not listening to this right now and correcting me on Facebook like they did last time?
Y-Wing is the one that's got the long tubes on the side.
Okay.
Google says so.
Yeah, Frank is agreeing with you.
Yes, that is the moving moment, the destruction of the Y-Wing, yes. That is correct. Thank you, Google. And now people are posting shit on my Facebook. Okay. fuck you. We figured it out already, but thanks for listening. When that thing goes, it goes sort of quietly, and it just sort of, and the camera, like, leaves it behind. It's actually a moving moment because we had that close-up on his face. We saw the last moment of his life. We saw his last breath. And... As sort of base as it sounds, that's sort of a manipulatively emotional shit, actually works. I mean, we see the face, we see the pain, we make eye contact, even though they're not really looking back at us. But we feel like we're making eye contact, and then their death seems more meaningful. And Gunn did a really good job of doing that in those final scenes. If we will criticize one thing about those, you want to talk about underutilized, Glenn Close.
Yeah, how did they get
her
for that
good.
Role?
But,
she
I mean,
really
how did they...
That.
Like, how do they only use her for that? I hate Glenn Close. Glenn Close, for me, is...
What?
There are certain performers, Al Pacino at this point is another one, who are always very clearly acting. They're very rarely performing. They're acting. And so every time I see them in anything, all I can see is someone repeatedly saying, I am an actor. I am acting. And it just drives me nuts. Glenn Close has been like that for years. Meryl Streep, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, for the most part. De Niro's had a couple of better roles. Al Pacino's been a caricature of himself for decades. But,
yeah.
But Glenn Close was suddenly great again. It actually made me remember why people like to cast her in things. And it's because she was being subtle and sarcastic and charming. And I was just like, how did you not, like, is there B-reel on the floor somewhere of her that you can please just, like, put in a box and send me so I can see the rest of it? Because I wanted so much more of her. And
well, at
it
least
was
she's clearly a recurring character.
I certainly hope so. And getting an actress of her caliber, they probably had to, you know, entice her with, you know, six seasons in a movie. But I thought she was perfectly downplaying everything, as opposed to John C. Reilly, who I thought hammed it up in ways that I didn't like. And I normally like him.
The John C. Reilly is kind of a perfect example of things that kind of threw me off in the movie. Because this is this alien world, yet a lot of, like, the Ravagers have southern accents. John C. Reilly, clearly, like, all the Nova Corps humans for some reason, as opposed to the more Green Lantern-esque, you know, all from different worlds. And that could have been a budget thing.
So I
have two theories on this one. Is one, I think it was partially a budget thing. The other being they wanted to get the hell away from Green Lantern because it was such a stinker that was a conscious decision. But, I mean, it's a perfect example of, like, John C. Reilly, like, he's great in some films. This was not one of them. It was a really weird casting.
I think they wanted Cole Meany, but they couldn't cast him because he's already too associated with Star Trek. But it would have been perfect for an Irish-accented, like, all of the lines that Reilly did would have been perfect coming from Cole Meany. And, yeah, he just... It seemed bad. I like Merle, though. I like the fact that the Ravagers had those southern accents. I thought that mapped on well. But then again, I live in the South, so I associate things like Ravagers with my neighbors. And
you post the most horrifying stories on Facebook. Like, I read your stuff, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm so glad I live in New York.
Yeah, I'm sort of glad I don't live in New York just because I do get to see a very different part of humanity, living in I live in rural Louisiana, so it is exciting, but I get to meet a lot of interesting people. And I will say that I only write about the things that I find amusing and entertaining that are horrible. Like, I don't write about the, you know, great conversation I have, you know, with this, like, 50-year-old black woman about tomatoes, which happened the other day. And we just sat there and talked about tomatoes, and she didn't know what an heirloom tomato was, even though she was sitting there in front of a giant tray of them that she was trying to sell me. And I'm like, no, these are heirloom. You can get, like, $8 more per tomato if you just call them heirloom. And
you're
she's
a good
like,
neighbor.
What? But I don't do that in part because I don't want to feel like I'm making fun of people for being stupid, and that's what that would come across, I think. If I posted something like that on Facebook, it would seem like... So I just, again, you know, post about, like, the gun nuts who threatened me and stuff.
Yeah, but I don't think that makes her look stupid. She's just operating in a different, like, market than I am.
I feel like it would appear as if I'm like, you know, city mouse going to the country and going, you don't know what you got here. You know, it's a gold mine. Let me come in and, you know, mine it for you. But getting back to the movie, because we don't really need to talk about my Facebook life, because if you want to know more about it, friend me on Facebook. you know, but Merle was great. I mean, I'm calling him Merle. That's his name, the name of the character on The Walking Dead. I can't remember the actual actor's name.
Carooker.
Yeah. I thought he was perfect right down to his, like, sprayed-on blue goatee, which is, you know, like, it's the epitome of the Southern douchebag, right, who wants to look like a guy in a Civil War photograph, so he shaves the mustache but leaves the... and he was actually menacing. Like, I think the film could have failed if he just seemed like a caricature of a villain, but he seemed both in the way that, and maybe it's just because I am such a fan of The Walking Dead and the way that he interacted with Daryl on it, like, I got both love and threat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these two were clearly in an abusive relationship, right?
And
Chris Pratt was trying to extricate himself from it. And this is a really weird thing to be talking about in the wake of the Ray Rice stuff this week, but this was an abusive relationship where there was also clearly love. And that's one of the things that sort of gets glossed over, I think, a lot in popular culture, which is that, yes, let's condemn people who beat their loved ones, but don't actually make it as if they don't love the ones that they beat, because that's where the pathos is. That's where the humanity is, right? I mean, it's awful that Adrian Peterson beats his kid with a switch, but he only does it because of the love that he holds for him, and that just makes it all the worse. And we tend to like to simplify things when we're demonizing people. And I think the film did a really good job of showing that love exists in an abusive relationship. Oh, my God. No one's recording this, are they? I understand what you're saying.
It was the same – I would say it's the same situation that he had with the character of Merle had with Daryl in Walking Dead, where it was very much an abusive relationship, but they clearly loved each other. I mean, the Yondu in Guardians, I thought, was very similar to Merle. In relationship-wise, just character-wise, Merle, I thought, was scared the shit out of me in The Walking Dead. I think Merle was the scariest thing compared to the zombies. Just because you didn't know what he was going to do, Every time I saw Merle, I thought it was Deliverance.
I'm very excited about Daryl possibly coming out as being gay on The Walking Dead. I really hope they follow through with that, but that's just a side note. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I don't watch it because it's not a cartoon.
But it has zombies, which are cartoonish.
Not those zombies.
Yeah, no, they're more nightmarish. But any other aspects of the film that you feel we haven't covered? Maybe someone on Facebook is yelling at me about something other than Y-Wings that we should talk about. Why is Zoe Saldana always a different color? That's actually probably something
we should
discuss.
I was thinking about that, too. It's clearly because she's this generation's Charlton Heston. They're always painting in different colors. Of course, that was because they were too racist to actually cast people
in
the roles that they cast him as. But nevertheless, that was my joke I was going for.
Well, no, I think the only reason I didn't start laughing is because it's so sadly true. Like, she is a real woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
She's done what, green, blue, and...
And she's actually going to do darker brown because she's going to be Nina Simone.
One, I think she's incredibly talented, and I think I love the fact that an actress of her stature is so devoted to sci-fi. Like,
yeah.
But it is sort of weird that she is, and I hate to put it like this, but she's like our colored actress now. in both respects. Like, she's, oh, we need a colored girl. Why don't we get, we'll paint her purple. Has she been purple yet? No,
right.
Okay.
But she was her own skin color in Star Trek. I totally
in Star
get
Trek.
What you're saying. But she was.
Except for
she
her
was
roommate. Yeah.
She was so good in Star Trek.
Yeah, I really, I just, I mean, I guess she can't be stereotyped as all of the colors because, you know, she'll be all of them. But and someone just mentioned on my Facebook page in response to this, in her next film, will she be playing someone who's Chinese and be yellow?
one hopes not.
Thank you, Facebook.
Wow.
I hope
Bravo.
Not to. That person was being sarcastic, as they
yeah.
are just noting.
Yeah, I figured.
But, there's something a little problematic that why can't – granted, Gamora, you know, she can't just be black, but why can't she just be like a black woman in space? You know, why does she always have
right.
to be the exotic other? Mm-hmm. Which she even sort of is in Star Trek, right? She still sort of plays the alluring exotic other, you know, that both Kirk and Spock are interested in the first one, and obviously it doesn't work out well for Kirk. But I don't know. I don't think she's going to get typecast or anything, or if she is, it's going to be an awesome. She'll be in the Farscape 20th anniversary movie or something. Oh, my God.
She's up there in comic
I
property.
I need to stop looking at my Facebook ones. People are just now being
I'm looking at your Facebook page now, too, but I'm not seeing any of this.
Oh, no, it's a private thing that I only set it up for, like, the
private.
15th. Well, because I know my friends.
No, it's good. Do we have any questions from our listeners?
Ooh, has anyone called in? People
no.
should call in.
No, but, I keep checking on Facebook. I don't know. I'm checking on Twitter.
Yeah. This
I
has been
about the Harper Marx thing, because that's so really so brilliant. So dead on.
Thank you. I like being both brilliant and dead on. But, no, now they're... Now, okay, see, now they're just making fun of us for talking about them.
at least it's interactive.
Yes, I have... My friends are meta assholes. let's see what they think about that. But in terms of, we didn't really talk about the comic, and the one thing that the comic makes plain that the movie only sort of alluded to is that this is yet another version of the white man saves them all, right? Like Avatar, in which the only way that the blue people can be saved is if they put a white brain in a blue body. It's the white savior.
Mm-hmm.
Narrative, right? And in
but
the
it's
comics,
not,
it's,
not
it's
their
explicit.
Team, but it's a team mm-hmm. that does it. And in fact, it's very clear that it's only the team working together that they're able to hold on to that power, that purple power stone. Oh my God, I can't believe I called it that. I apologize to the internet.
Yeah.
But it's only because of the fact that they were all holding hands together and doing it together that they were able to save the world.
But he's
so
also the son of the king of the universe, and he's only
we don't know
half
that yet.
Human. We don't know
we don't
that,
know
but
that
I'm
yet.
Saying in terms of, like, you know, we were talking
in
about
the
it
comics,
earlier, talking about the spoilers in the comics.
Yeah, yeah, in the comics
it's apparent
much more.
From the beginning that he's half alien. It's another Messiah, like, he's another chosen one. He's another Harry Potter, right? He is chosen from the beginning. And so what I'll say is that I agree with you. I like the fact that the film made it about the team. The comic clearly makes it about Star-Lord in a non-ironic way. Because he is literally the Star-Lord, the princeling to the Star-King. Like, the movie actually... Go on.
I was going to say, in the comic, it's even more blatant. In his solo series, he incites a revolution to overthrow his oppressive king. So White Boy comes back to free his people. When he has a half-sister who is... I guess she's black. I don't know. That's one's a little bit confusing. But, you know, she's like the hunter and trying to take him on, but it, I think in the comic, yeah, I completely agree with you. In the comic, it's very different tone and presentation as to what the center of everything is.
Whereas this made it very much like the, I don't know, and the much maligned seventh season of Buffy, right, where it was, you know, without Willow, Xander, and, you know, Dawn helping, and Anya, poor Anya, helping Buffy to save the world and to make all of the potential slayers into slayers, right? Like, Buffy turned into this, even though, you know, the title is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, turned into the everyone is this kind of, it's all about teamwork, it's all about the Scooby Gang. I like the fact that this movie turned to that in the end and moved away from the comics and moved away from the white savior complex, because I'm not looking forward to the next two Avatar films, right, which is, how will Whitey save him again? Oh, those blue people always get into trouble. Someone send a white guy in to sort them out. Like, oh, really? do we need this again? I mean, there's a reason that, you know, the film is called Dances with Smurfs, at least in my head.
For real. Or Ferngully.
Yeah,
for Ferngully. But I like Dances with Smurfs. That's pretty accurate.
I mean, it's just so I like the fact that they made it about teamwork, and I love the fact that in the one of the behind-the-scenes things I saw, he actually, instead of saying, you know, when Ronan asks him, who are you, and he says, you know, you already answered that, instead of saying, we're the Guardians of the Galaxy, he actually responded, I'm Burt Macklin, bitch. but that was the wrong approach. I like the we're the Guardians of the Galaxy, and I know it's a cheesy fucking moment in the film. And my wife was like, I love the entire film except for that, because it felt like an after-school special for a minute there.
Aww.
I liked that. It's like, I watched after-school specials growing up. They taught me valuable lessons about stranger danger, locking the door when I'm home alone, and, but you know, also things like teamwork. And I think that moment actually worked emotionally, even if, as a bit of dialogue, I wish they would have not needed the heroic moments that they seem to need. And but that's a very minor complaint. And okay, here's the last thing I'll say, because I feel like I've talked way too much and I've had a lot of espresso. But so have I in any way convinced you that the film might be better than you thought it was before we started this podcast?
I'm willing to watch it again. And
that's a victory.
And yeah, and check it out. Yeah, it's one, like, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. It's just one of those things, is like all those small minor things just totally threw me out of it. So I'm willing to watch it again and see
if... Let it go.
Yeah,
let
exactly.
Go.
I just need to let it go. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. But it had Cosmo, so I'm happy.
Yeah. And anything that...
That
complicates sci-fi.
Oh, so for those that don't know, the dog that's in there is a long-standing guardian character.
Oh, I thought you said Cosmos. No, yeah, Cosmo
no,
wasn't.
Cosmo.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something about a Russian, a dog that's psychic that speaks with a Russian accent that I love.
Oh, I mean, it's freaking brilliant. That's brilliant. I mean, because that's the dog the Russians sent into space.
Yep.
It made me cry when it was in that movie. Oh, my God.
Yeah. No, I mean, and... I mean, Cosmo is such an important character in the comics that his cameo was a little annoying to me, because he was actually almost literally a cameo in a case until it all blew up and then he just walked by.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
I thought it was great when the woman who's the servant of the collector, who's like the slave, she like rebels and like tries to and like when she rebels and you know. Just basically pulls the plug on everything. That was pretty incredible, you know?
It was, but that's one of those moments where I was like, thank God I'm not a political scientist, because she's a suicide bomber.
Yeah, there was a lot of suicide bombing in the movie.
No, she didn't necessarily know what was going to happen. It was her shot in the dark. It was a gamble.
Yeah. No, I like your reading much better than mine.
I didn't read it as a suicide bomber thing at all, because it was. She was like, maybe I can harness this power. Like, I am somebody, right?
And then the universe said, no.
No. But it's because she was human-ish, or whatever purple thing, and because she was alone.
But, well, her twin was, or fellow clone, was in the case behind her.
But the thing is, she fucked that guy's shit up. So she did do something.
Absolutely. I find your interpretation both more persuasive than mine and more palatable. She really did fuck his shit up.
Right?
Yeah.
He's clearly lost a lot of money. Also, Howard the Duck, definitely going to be in the sequel.
Oh, God, please no. Or if he is, at least make it like a buddy film with him and Alf or something. I don't...
Here's the thing that everyone seemed to miss on it. So they had Howard the Duck, and then they referenced Man-Thing in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
And both those characters in the comics have been almost like buddy-buddy for a few years now. So I'm wondering if we finally get Howard the Duck.
I love Man-Thing.
I saw that nowhere. And no one pointed out like these two guys have been together for a while now, at least in the comics.
I think it's because... I don't know.
I think the only way they could
do Howard the Duck again, though, would be if on a dare. I mean, that would have to be like a drunken bet on the Skywalker Ranch.
If you guys are watching BoJack Horseman, the cartoon, that would really make you feel like the world needs a Howard the Duck remake, probably starring BoJack Horseman.
Okay, I need to find what this is.
Yes, no, and I know, I understand exactly what you're saying, but I don't think it could be called Howard the Duck. I mean, I think it's just, you know, that'd be like Ishtar Part 2, like, you know.
Be like, what?
There's
what?
A good Ishtar 2, like, I mean, there's a germ of a good movie in there, but it's just so tainted by how poorly the material was handled. You know, I say that, and now I'm remembering the early 90s, late 80s Captain America movie, and I realize that proves me exactly wrong, that you can, in fact... All right, well, fuck what I just said. I'm wrong. Let's start the Howard the Duck Man-Thing buddy cop movie petition. Can we do like a petition?
Can you just have them going around?
There's so many petitions necessary, though. There's like,
this is a change.org one. I feel whitehouse.gov could be hilarious, though.
Hey, if we get 100,000 people to sign it,
they have to respond.
The White House will have to respond.
No, they just keep increasing the number. I think it's more than 100,000 now. I think they were requiring that like 50% of all Americans sign it or something.
Well, then we have our work cut out for us.
Yeah.
Done and done. I am creating this tomorrow, and we are making this happen.
All right. Forward me the link. I will use my vast influence of whatever to get at least another 500 signatures I think I could manage. And if I don't, I will just berate everyone I know.
The president is a comic fan.
He is, although there was an article in the New York Times a couple of years ago with a profile of Rachel Maddow where they photographed her in front of a wall of books. And if you actually look at the wall of books behind her, and this is the same room that she actually interviewed President Obama in, if you look at the wall of books behind her, all graphic novels. Hmm. All graphic novels. This is one of those things that just made me like, you know, Rachel Maddow even more than I already did, which I didn't think possible, but it was. And when you start looking through it, it's not just the good ones that, you know, you put out to impress your friends. Like, oh, yes, here's my Alan Moore collection. And, you know, oh, look, Fun Home and Blankets. And, you know, it's like all the crappy, you know, not crappy, but all the mediocre John Byrne X-Men.
Yeah.
You know, all the.
Yeah.
Like, she has all of them on her wall.
She wrote the intro to Batwoman for DC.
She did,
and it
was really good.
Yeah.
Could you imagine what it would be like to have been in that room when Obama actually looked at her wall of comic books? Like, what did he say? Like, did they have that moment that we want them to have had? Like, oh. X-Men 189. Oh, man. Do you remember when Forge and Storm? Oh, it's like, okay, that's my version of politics, at least in my head. Would have been great.
All right, well,
anyway, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, I was about to say we're kind of going over the allotted time, so I think we just kind of got cut off, but it's still recording, so people will at least be able to read it, listen to it on the playback. Yeah.
Well, they only missed the good
part.
Well,
thanks, guys.
And that's the
sign
to wrap
up. Yeah.
And feel free to invite me back whenever you want. I clearly don't enjoy doing this at all.
So good.
No, we love having you. This is fantastic.
I have started watching Arrow, so we can finally discuss Arrow.
And oh, crap.
I've begun season three. Okay, it is a cartoon. It's a cartoon.
Right. Sarah Rauscher, when she was on, made the same argument with me. So.
And plus,
I will say it
you're
gets
not going
to
be able to get into Flash if you don't watch the second season of Arrow. And Flash, I've already, I guess I'm allowed to say this, I've already seen the first five episodes of Flash because I'm a professional film critic and I have access to those things. Oh, my God,
mm-hmm.
Flash is good.
Oh,
it
really?
So good. It captures the character so perfectly, like much better than Arrow captures.
Well, obviously Arrow doesn't capture Green Arrow because, like, TV is not going to put on actual Oliver Queen in any recognizable form because TV is stupid.
Oh,
TV
no,
put him on.
Second season of Arrow, they do get to be
around.
Oliver Queen socialist. It's nice.
Really?
Very slow. I will give the show credit. When I first watched it, I said the same thing, is that he's not the kind of socialist that he should be, but there's a gradual shift from the first season through the second season that comes along nicely. It's very organic and it makes sense. And I'll give the series a lot of credit on that one.
Yeah, and Flash, this is gonna sound very lame, but it hits the ground running. I'm very sorry for that. It really does. This is who Barry Allen is. This is what he does, and it just gets going. So we should talk about that at some future point.
Sure, yeah. I'll watch.
Yeah. What are you gonna talk about next week? You want to invite me back? I'll be around.
Well, we got the so the whole thing is all the shows are gonna be debuting. Gotham starts next Monday. They're going to be slowly going out. I think we need to do a review of the 3 billion comic television shows that are going to be on the air.
Absolutely.
Right, we owe it to society.
Yes. All right. So just keep me in the loop and,
all right.
Tell me when to call in and maybe be more specific with Eastern Central Time because I'm dumb and have problems.
No, you know
with
what time we mean. We mean Eastern Time. We're completely imperialist and sensitive to your needs.
The East Coasters.
I'm just saying, when I call in an hour early and you're like, what the fuck are you doing?
Oh,
it's on
sorry.
You.
No, I'm looking at that New Yorker poster right now. I'm not actually. I don't actually have a cartoon right now. But pretend I am. That's my attitude for its time zones.
All right.
Well, this has been great, and I'll post it in my places tomorrow, and I look forward to seeing how much people hate us.
Well, we gotta give
That's
you your plugs. Wait, before you go, we gotta give your plugs so people can find you and do the nice stuff. So, where can people find you when you're not here?
Well, I'm the associate editor or one of the associate editors at the Raw Story, so rawstory.com, in which I kind of scavenge the internet for the oddest local news stories and try to make them, something of national import. I have a new column with the AV Club coming, or a new post with the AV Club this week. It'll be about Community and the Winter Soldier, actually. Things we've discussed here might be mentioned. That'll be going live on Thursday at avclub.com. You can always find me at Lawyers, Guns, and Money and acephalus.typebag.com. And I think that's all the places I'm on the internet at the moment. It's a lot. Freelancing is hard.
Yeah.
But yeah.
All right.
So that's it
cool.
for me.
All right. Appreciate you coming on, as always. It's fantastic, and I think we have a long list of things to discuss. I'm just going to have to re-listen to this so I remember what. Oh, yeah. It was the fall TV season that is not comic-related. It was one of them, because I think Selfie would be a fascinating conversation.
Absolutely.
Plus
I'd be
Black-ish.
Up for that.
I don't know if you watch Black-ish yet.
I don't, but I probably should. It's on servers I have access to, and I'd be more than happy to talk about it.
Yeah. It'd be the whole ABC thing is fascinating. They have a mix of lead characters of all kinds of races, and how each is portrayed, and how the quality of the show is, I will say, all over the place. But yeah, that's a conversation for another time. So Scott, thank you very much for coming on, as always. It's great to have you on. So that wraps up another episode of Graphic Policy Radio. You can find us every single day at graphicpolicy.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, et cetera, all around the web at Graphic Policy. We keep it consistent. Until next time, I'm Brett.
And I'm Ilana.
And keep it geeky.